The Mark Stein Club Q&A, live around the planet, begins in 30 seconds.
Hey, this is Mark Stein. Join me for Songs Across the Century, songs around the world, from the continent and from the Commonwealth, and songs for swinging superheroes. Plus, for all you lower back pain sufferers out there, Frank Sinatra sings the Sacroiliac Songbook. On the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. August 21st, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in Plymouth, England, where Abal Zak Sali, Saif Kaya, and Anthony Anantaraja. Actually, that last one could probably be Welsh. But Messrs. Sali, Kaya, and Anantaraja have been found guilty of multiple counts of vaginal and anal rape of girls under 16. They're likely to get almost as long a jail sentence as you will for writing a Facebook post about it. 9 p.m. in Brussels, where EuroMP Sandro Gozzi has told Elon Musk to comply with the EU censorship regime, or the European Commission will, quote, completely dismantle the platform in the territory of the Union. 10 p.m. in Kyiv, where Parliament has approved a law banning the Russian Orthodox Church outright and giving itself the powers to ban the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran in solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers. I'm sorry about that, but they're lively bugs, so a lot of people will still be up. 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a rather more agreeable hour for the Kippers and Kedgeri in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. On this day, 80 years ago, August 21st, 1944, the Dumbarton Oaks Conference opened in Washington, D.C. to plan the creation of what was to be the United Nations. Don't get me started. We have breaking news. RFK Jr., independent candidate for president, will address the nation on Friday. There are a lot of rumors flying around. He's going to be addressing said nation from Arizona, where the Republican candidate happens to be holding a rally. As I said, a lot of rumors going around. We also have, aside from the breaking news, we have some non-breaking news from the Washington Post on Joe Biden. Quote, his inner circle worked to conceal his decline. Unquote. Oh, really? Really? Now it can be told. It is the practice of America's garbage media to disclose useful information only after its sell-by date, when it has ceased to be of any use. So, Joe Biden's inner circle worked to conceal his decline. Thanks for sharing. The Washington Post also worked to conceal his decline, but now you're willing to admit that he was in decline and that various parties were working to conceal it. Have you noticed he's still the chief executive of the United States? And if they were working to conceal his decline, it's presumably because he's not capable of carrying out those functions. So who actually is running America right now? It's all bollocks, boys and girls. The logic, even by the logic of what the Washington Post and co. are saying now, we have a far more interesting question before us than any of the ones being put at the Democrat convention. Who is in charge of America? Who's making the decisions? Who's run? Hey, Joe Biden can't name his Secretary of State. You really think he's running American foreign policy? This is stupid, even by the worthless standards of American presidential politics. I'm getting a bit too excited. I haven't even taken a question yet. So let's get to a question and maybe it'll calm me down. Eric Dale says, Mark and fellow club members, did you catch the roll call vote nominating Kamala Harris as the Democratic presidential nominee? You really think I would? Well, I mean, I used to, long time ago, I used to like the bit where the guy would say, the great state of New Hampshire, home of Laconia Speedway, cast its votes for. I used to enjoy the rituals, but since the rituals have completely disconnected from reality, the rituals just annoy me now. So no, I didn't catch the roll call vote. What does it say about the Democratic rank and file party members enthusiastically supporting a nominee that their party has given them absolutely no say in choosing? Indeed, what does it say about voters and democracy in general that this is probably a winning strategy rather than a landslide defeat with massive defections to third parties? Well, to answer that last part of the question, it's because even in a constitutional republic, as you constitution waivers like to say, even in a constitutional republic, the neo-monarchical urge persists. Why do you think America has political dynasties? Why do you think we are supposed, well, just to go from the latest example, the wife of a former president gave the speech, Michelle Obama. That's odd. A political speech, that's odd. You know, there are a lot of countries where the public are barely aware that the Prime Minister has a wife. There's a lot of people. For example, Jean Chrétien was, in his own terms, a highly successful and long-serving Prime Minister of Canada. Yet, for almost all his term, I would bet you that a majority of Canadians could not name his wife, would not have been able to pick her out of a police lineup and had no idea what she thought about anything. But the neo-monarchical urge persists. So the fact that Barack Obama or Bill Clinton were presidents confers a status on their wives. The fact that George Bush was president confers a status not only on one son, but on two sons. Remember Jeb versus Hillary in a republic of 300 million people or whatever it was back then. And you can't come up with anything better than the wife of the previous guy and the brother and son of the previous guys. The neo-monarchical urge. So this idea that people actively resent the democratic deficit, democratic small d, in the choice of this particular candidate, I think is a little misplaced. I think it's the same, particularly on the Democrat side. I don't know whether it would be quite the same on the Republican side, but on the Democrat side, a lot of those people are the same kind of people who are interested in the movie grosses when they watch the Today Show on Monday morning, because they want to go and see the same movie everybody else is going to see. That's why they have the best-selling books at the front of the bookstore, so you can read what everybody else is reading. A lot of people, there is, I would say that is actually fairly... fairly deeply ingrained. It's why people are. It's why people in what's supposed to be a democratic age is why people are happy for Bill Gates to be running the planet's public health. They think it's natural. Oh, he's a successful man, so let's have him decide the public health of all 8 billion people on the planet. There's a lot of that about, and particularly on the left side. Now, I've said more generally that we are actually moving into a post-democratic age when you look at the imposition of Rishi Sunak, you know, the way they Liz Truss was Prime Minister of the UK for 3 weeks, which was almost all taken up with royal mourning and burying the Queen. And then the Queen was eventually buried and the royal mourning ended, and she had like 3 days as Prime Minister, and then they decided to get rid of her. Likewise, the President of France is this guy nobody had heard of until it became clear that Monsieur Hollande, the incumbent socialist, dared not run again because, like Joe Biden, he was going to lose very badly. So they found this mysterious little globalist technocrat and just put him on the French stage as the world's biggest star, and he became the president. Now they're doing the same here. If you notice, there's a pattern of this. And that's because the only approved candidates are going to be permitted to win and serve. And as Eric has suggested, the public, at least on the Democrat side, seem very cool with that. It's interesting, but I was talking about that neo-monarchical thing. That works for a while, but it's interesting that RFK, whom we were talking about earlier, hasn't really benefited from that because he's got, you know, the highest name recognition of any family in American politics. And yet, because he has wandered off the reservation on certain issues like the COVID vaccines and other things, he doesn't benefit from that. Interesting. Joel in Sacramento, which I believe is in the great state of California, as someone is probably saying on the floor of the Democrat convention right now, says, Joel in Sacramento says, greetings, Mark. On a philosophical level, which truly is the worse human condition? To have had somewhat of a mind and lost it, or to have never had it in the first place? The DNC probing this existential mystery with a live experiment does present some challenging dilemmas. Yeah. Because basically, Kamala Harris is half Joe Biden's age and has even fewer marbles, which is odd. Except that if we go back to what I just said, if the person who is the chief magistrate of the United States is in fact merely a ceremonial position, and the same people, the permanent state is just always running things, and you just have this rotating cast of feeble persons in the front office, then that doesn't really matter. What is interesting, though, is that I think I don't think the Kamala Joy thing is real at all. I think that's totally fakey-fake, and I don't think this convention has been a big hit for the Harris Waltz ticket. Waltz, I don't get at all because he seems to me creepy and weird. And so I don't buy this, oh, he's America's dad and all the rest of it. I don't think so. As I said, and it might just be because I'm a unlikable foreigner myself, so I just don't get it. And that could be true. That has certainly happened to me in respect to other things in the past. But I don't get Waltz as a popular. I think Waltz is you'd only pick Waltz if you were completely disconnected from basic the necessary genuflections that one has to make to public opinion, because I don't believe he's, and I think, you know, I could find some for people who believe polls, which I don't. But the interesting thing about that is that the Kamala honeymoon is extremely minimal. I mean, I look at these Real Clear Politics poll of polls things for whatever they're worth, and I don't think they're worth much. But there has been no runaway groundswell. And then in the betting odds, where people are actually putting on their money, Kamala's gone down during the convention. I don't think the convention's worked for her. But I think the reason we're getting candid, look, this is, what did I say? That it's a nation of 300 million and it's Jeb versus Hillary. Well, now, whatever it is, 8 years on, it's a nation of 400 million. Because the number of undocumented immigrants in the country has stayed consistently at 11 million for 25 years now. So it's probably closer to 400 million people. In a nation of 300 million, you know, aside from the fact that they're the son and wife of former presidents, you can see that in a certain sense, they're serious choices. Biden and Harris and Waltz are not serious choices. And I've had some emails during the week suggesting that the so-called normies, normal people, are beginning to get that the jig is up. I don't think so. Because if the jig is up, I mean, if you think the unprecedented American debt, which will destroy the dollar. And this isn't even a conspiracy now, because you can see that the emerging powers on the planet, America's rivals, we're not talking about its client states in Europe or whatever, but we're talking about everybody else are moving to the post-dollar world. And when that move is complete, the dollar's just going to collapse. The dollar's just going to collapse, and it's going to be Zimbabwe. Because that's the only reason that America isn't Zimbabwe is because we were talking about, what was it, the Dumbarton Oaks Conference? Yeah, then they had the Bretton Woods Conference in New Hampshire, and they decided to make the dollar the global currency. Now, the minute it loses that status, boomf, everything collapsed. Do you think even, you know, the trusty fundy types in New England used to be very sensitive to things like that. They're the sort of people, they maintain their position by never dipping into their principle. You know, they used to grasp that, but they don't grasp it with, if you think America is facing a looming issue of credit and credibility, why would you put either Harris or Waltz in charge of that? George of the Jungle says, all the talk about November's presidential election. I'll try and get through this with a straight face. There seems to be little chat about the congressional races. I think you're at the wrong... I think you're at the wrong website, George. I think maybe you should be at the National Review website or one of those Cumulus radio shows. But George continues, isn't the latter, the congressional races, possibly the deal maker or deal breaker here? A Kamala Harris White House is a real possibility, and with that could come a vast garbage wave of Hugo Chavez-style economics, bonkers slavery reparations activism, and general identity politics malarkey. At least one of the houses had better be in opposition hands to fight off all this. Okay, I'm going to try and stay calm. You know, the last time the White House, the House of Representatives, and the Senate were in Republican hands, it was Donald Trump's first term. And Paul Ryan and the guy who freezes, what's he called, Mitch McConnell, all they did was subvert the agenda that had gotten Trump elected, so that the entire Trump presidency was undone about 10 minutes after Joe Biden took office. If you remember, at midday on January the 20th, he took office and he was sitting at his desk and they put all this stuff in front of him and he signed this page, he signed that page, he signed the other page. All the stuff that Trump had done by executive orders, because the rock-ribbed Republicans of Congress had subverted his agenda. So all the things that you're talking about here, Hugo Chavez-style economics, bonkers slavery reparations, general identity politics malarkey. How many Republican senators are there willing to stand against all that? You know, we've got so-called Republican governors, you know, including one who was being considered as Trump's vice president, who are on board with all the tranny insanity, and including ones who were thought of as, you know, basically conservative, like that guy Asa Hutchinson. We are getting to a stage. The problem here, and I've understood this. It's in the nature of politics, and I've understood it basically. At least since I got into trouble with the human rights commissions in Canada, because I came to understand Warren Kinsella, who was the Liberal Party attack dog and was a famous person in Canada at that point, said people aren't going to put up with crazies like Mark Stein and Ezra Levant playing smash mouth with their beloved human rights commissions. Well, the reason why we went Magna Carta on their medieval asses, as we used to put it, was because you had to do that to get the so-called conservative polity. You had to move 6 miles in one direction to get a rock-ribbed conservative politician, with a few exceptions, to move half an inch. And that's the problem here. The problems that America faces are now so profound and existential that it's going to be very, I mean, even someone who understands that, the one thing about J.D. Vance, I have no idea whether J.D. Vance would make a good vice president or a good president, but just when he's in chit-chat, he understands what's going on, right? Which is interesting to me, because Lindsey Graham doesn't understand what's going on. Or if he does, he only understands his little piece of it, what matters to him. But J.D. Vance has got an instinctive grasp of what's going on. Same with Vivek. People go on about Vivek Ramaswamy. Vivek Ramaswamy understands what's going on. The question then becomes, you know, these guys, whoever is going to be this season's Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, whether they get what's going on and whether they're prepared to do anything about it. Let's see, what do we got here? Jeff Estes. Oh, Jeff says, the Democrats are using the same 2020 playback playbook, playback playbook for the Harris campaign, hiding the candidate and waiting for midnight to bring in prepared ballots. Despite it being so obvious, I see no evidence anything substantive has been done to counter this plan. Would like to hear your thoughts on what happens the day after. Well, what happens the day after will be what happens the day after all the time. I mean, if you take Pennsylvania, okay, at 10 o'clock, Trump will be 50,000 votes ahead in Pennsylvania. So then they'll announce that they're closing down for the night and they'll resume in the morning and at 9 o'clock in the morning. And so all the poll workers go home and then the unmarked vans start showing up with the ballots from who knows where. And what's going to happen then? The United States Supreme Court will sit it out as they did last time. And the question then becomes, what about these so-called congressional Republicans that everyone's worked so hard to get elected and that we were just hearing about from George of the Jungle? What are they going to do? Are they going to do that thing they did, where they just urged Trump to accept the result? Just think about it for a moment. You know, has any of the stuff that enabled what happened in 2020 to happen, has any of it been corrected in the 6 or 7 states where the election will be won or lost? Patrick Gagan says, hello, Mark. Pennsylvania's come out. Do you know, when I say we've cut all the music because it frees up more time to talk about who's up 2 points in Pennsylvania, I meant that as a joke. I didn't mean for it to become a thing. Anyway, Patrick says, Pennsylvania has come out not long ago and said that we won't find out who won the election on Election Day. Yeah, I think we did that as breaking news. Was it last week or the week before? I feel if Trump isn't able to beat the cheat, he will be jailed and then murdered while his family is destroyed to make an example of them. If I were Trump, I would take your advice and keep a list of non-extradition countries in my pocket. Your thoughts are appreciated as always. It's more than that. I can at least flee. And as you know, the whatever it was on the Mark Steyn show, whatever it was, 2 weeks after Election Day in 2020, I recommended that Trump get the hell out, not on Air Force One. I recommended that he take his own plane and fly to a country without an extradition treaty. In the absence of that, as you know, I offered him what I offered Conrad Black. He should get in the flatbed of my pickup and I'd toss a tarp over him and drive him over into Quebec. And the problem he faces is whether, unlike me, he would be allowed to get out of the country. You know, that's the point. The point about having a so-called Secret Service detail is they don't just prevent people getting at you, supposedly, but they prevent you doing anything that might be in your interest, such as getting the hell out of the United States. But I think what we've... I mean, again, the... Trump assassination attempt has been completely memory holed. It's incredible. It's like it never happened. And the Democrats, if they do acknowledge that there was some kind of incident, think it was all faked up by him to look butch. And every detail that has emerged since then testifies to the fact that at the bare minimum, the Secret Service permitted it to happen, which is to say, and I don't see why this should be surprising to anybody when you look at people, when you look at what happens to people who cross the deep state, and I'm not just talking about Trump, they don't mind some, they wouldn't have let Jeb get assassinated. They wouldn't let Nikki Haley get assassinated, but they're perfectly willing to let Trump get assassinated, just as they're perfectly willing to let Jeffrey Epstein mysteriously commit suicide at a time when the security cameras have ceased to work and the guards are asleep. Do they want Trump dead? Yes, in the same way that they wanted Jeffrey Epstein. They didn't want Jeffrey Epstein sitting in a witness box in New York and testifying on this, that, and the other. It's very interesting. There's an interesting story out of the UK that you may have heard one side of. This guy, I think he's called Mike Lynch. He's a big tech guy. And his yacht sank off Sicily on Monday. It's now Wednesday, and no one knows where he is. His yacht's on the bottom of the sea, on the bottom of the Mediterranean, but it's very difficult to get into, so they don't know whether there's an air pocket that he might have survived in or whatever. But anyway, he's either dead or in an air pocket at the bottom of the Mediterranean. Now, this guy, and the only reason I know this, I don't really know anything about this guy or about his company, but he had the misfortune to attract the attention of the United States Department of Justice, and he was extradited. He and his business partner were extradited to San Francisco, I think it was, and they were put on trial there. And here's the funny, this is the only reason I even know of his existence, and I didn't connect it with this sunken yacht until other day. But I take, because of my own particular legal problems and because of those of friends of mine like Conrad Black, I take a great interest in the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice, who, as Conrad always likes to say, win 99% of their cases without ever going to trial. Well, these guys went to trial, and amazingly, they won. So I remembered it because this guy and his business partner had beaten the rap and had beaten the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt U.S. Department of Justice. Now, what's interesting to me is this guy's yacht sank on Monday. His business partner was killed in a hit and run on the Saturday. In fact, I think he lingered in a coma or as brain dead until they switched him off on the Monday. So technically, I think the two guys died the same day, right? The two of the few defendants who've beaten the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice, and they both die on the same day. And we're just expected to believe that kind of thing. Now, we were told with Julian Assange, oh yeah, we can't commit to allowing him the protections of the First Amendment because there seems to be some doubt as to whether that applies to foreigners. That was of interest to me too, by the way. but there's no doubt in my mind that Julian Assange, had he been extradited to America, would never have set foot in the witness box. What is it? It's not witness box here. It's on the witness stand, right? He would have mysteriously died in the Supermax or wherever they were going to hold him. So he's very lucky to have got out of that. So now we're supposed to think that, you don't have to worry about Trump. If this judge, who it's looking more and more from all the inside scuttlebutt as if they're going to send him to jail when he's given his sentencing hearing in September. That's another corrupt thing, by the way. Sentencing should follow directly from conviction. You shouldn't have, this elongated period in which the sentencing can be tweaked according to how the political winds blow. It's all garbage. Don't wave that constitution at me. It's all filthy rubbish. It's a perversion of a justice system. And Trump should not, Trump does need to get out. And you're right too. because I think the idea, they want him dead, because that's the best way to... There's a bit in Prisoner of Windsor about this. I was thinking about this, because there's a bit where the Home Secretary does what the present Home Secretary does in London, and gets people with the wrong political opinions banged up. And in this case, in The Prisoner of Windsor, it's an Australian blogger. And the Australian blogger is mysteriously gets into a fight in prison and is reduced to a vegetable. And that's actually going to be the fate of a lot of these people who have been sent to jail for the Southport riots and that are going to be going into, basically have been convicted of being Islamophobes and are going into prisons that are run by Islamic gangs. And so there's a, I think the same thing is going to apply in America, that if they do get Trump in prison, they will want to kill him. They don't want him to be, the difficulty for Trumpism has been, it's very hard. It'd be interesting to see whether J.D. Vance can do this, whether the Trump issues and the issues he ran on in 2016 will survive after Trump. But I think they do want him dead. And then you say, while his family is destroyed, to make an example of them. Yep, if you think any of those, Don Jr. or Eric or any of them, the thing is to teach a lesson, and they're going to destroy those guys completely too. So it's beyond having a list of non-extradition countries in his pocket. You know, he needs to have active plans to get the hell out without the his so-called Secret Service, quote-unquote, protection getting him. That's my view on that. Let us pause a moment from the passing charity. Oh, wait, we don't do that anymore, do we? We've moved all the music on this show over to Serenade Radio, Saturdays at 5 p.m. London time, in order to free up more time here to talk about who's up 2 points in Pennsylvania. You know, these polls, if they do mean anything. The last polls I saw, Trump is hanging. What I don't get is if there's so much joy out there, it's not reflected in the battleground state polls. That is certainly the case, because I think 5 out of the most critical 7 Trump's still up in. That's if you believe these are real polls, of course. At any rate, I'm getting eerily fascinated by polls in Pennsylvania. But that's because there's no music, because our show will ne'er be sullied by my niche Canadian musical obsessions again. However, if you would like a break from Who's Up 2 points in Pennsylvania, don't forget our new tale for our time. It's a very timely one. The Flying In by G.K. Chesterton, airing nightly right here at Stein Online at about 7 p.m., North American Eastern. That's midnight London time. It is 23 to 4 North American Eastern time, and that is 23 to 9 British summer time. Yeah, I'm working it out. We're live around the planet. If you're in neither New York or London, then it's a little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you do chance to be on this turbulent earth. But we are cramming in more questions. Chris Davis. Chris. Chris, I'm so grateful to Chris. He threw this lovely party for me when I was in London at the Royal Courts of Justice. It was a lovely party with so many friends there and from all kinds. And people had come from, people had flown in not just from remote parts of the kingdom. There were people there from mid-Ulster, but also from the continent, from Spain, from all kinds of places. There were Canadians there. So I really appreciated that that party. Chris says, Mark, I hope you are relatively well. Do you think you'd retain your liberty in the UK now if you attempted to make the Mark Steyn Show? Given the subjects you covered, I have my doubts. Yes, we're seeing it's basically the de facto criminalization of real opposition. So we have these two stories where I wasn't joking when I said at the beginning, I was talking about these three guys who'd anally raped, they'd sodomized these girls under 16. And I said, they'll be getting a sentence almost as long as you'll be getting for writing a Facebook post about it. I'm not joking about that. We're told that these people have to be imprisoned because they'd passed on false information. I didn't. If you recall, the first thing I said about this, the stabbings of these poor girls, was that this site, because it was called something like Channel 3 Live Now, and I'd never heard of it. And when you tried to find out anything about it, you couldn't. It seemed to have just been, it was just created for the purpose. And they'd said that the guy who'd done the stabbings was a Muslim who'd come in on one of these small boats and was on an MI6 or an MI5 watch list. And in fact, they just arrested a guy in Pakistan, a Pakistani Muslim, who started and launched that rumor, right? So all these people who've gone to jail in Britain, they were set up by a Muslim who'd planted this rumor, presumably to make the so-called far right look bad. And when Keir Starmer blamed it on the far right, it turns out it wasn't the far right who started that rumor. It was a Muslim. It was a Pakistani Muslim. But are those people now going to be sprung from jail on the grounds that they were succored by a Pakistani Muslim? I don't think so. I don't, because it's January the 6th. That's the model they all use now. January the 6th was the same thing. A lot of agent provocateurs on the streets of Washington. A lot of G-men, right? Those straight-shooting G-men. Sean Hannity's all over, right? A lot of those guys on the streets of Washington on January the 6th, just as there were in the Governor Whitmer case and all the other bollocks that goes on. Agent provocateur. Well, the same thing happened with these Southport stabbings of little girls. An agent provocateur, a Muslim agent provocateur, a Pakistani agent provocateur launched a false rumor that the girls had been stabbed by a Muslim who'd come in on a boat and was on an MI5 watch list. But it didn't matter. It doesn't matter that, because you find that out, you know, as the weeks and months go by. But by then, the big shots in the government have established the narrative. Oh, our democracy was at risk. Anyway, I don't know. Just to answer your question, Chris, I don't know, because I couldn't... The lie, basically, even if you've fallen for this rubbish from Channel 3 News Live Now, or whatever it was called, that it was a guy with a Muslim name who was on an MI5 watch list. You know, that's not why people were on... People weren't on the streets for that reason. People on the streets for migrants generally. Because it's all too confusing now. In Frankfurt Railway Station the other... It doesn't even matter. It's not... It's what they're doing... Okay, they're stabbing little girls, and it speaks very poorly for the craven manhood of England that they're prepared to tolerate the stabbing of little girls. I mentioned there was an 8-year-old stabbed in Christchurch in Dorset just yesterday. These are terrible things for which people should be on the street. And it doesn't matter whether it's a Muslim who does it, or as it was in the case of Southport, it's a Rwandan, or as it was in this case in Dorset, whoever that turns out to be. There's all kinds of things. It's when you turn yourself into just some great cacophonous crap hole in which everybody from every corner of the earth is all crammed into an already overcrowded island. People are going to be stabbing each other. As I point out, London is so diverse now that in a lot of these cases, there's no Londoners involved. There's no Englishman involved. There's no Scotsman, Irishman, Welshman involved. It's just one. There was a thing out of Frankfurt Railway Station, I think it was last couple of days, where one Turk kills another Turk, right? So no Germans. The Germans, who used to be famous for killing people on a grand scale, are now mere bystanders in their own fate, which is what diversity and multiculturalism reduce everyone to. Glenn Flint says, so yeah, I wouldn't be, just, yeah, the Mark Steyn show, yeah, I wouldn't be, I'd want to tell the truth about this. You know, we had people like Sammy Woodhouse and Samantha Smith on the show because they're girls whose lives were destroyed because nobody cared about them. Right, because in their case, they were just subjected to rape and sexual assault and all kinds of terrible things. And now girls even younger than that are being stabbed just because there's all kinds of people who don't see them as little girls. They see them as the other. I mentioned the, where was that? Was it Denmark? Wherever, or maybe it was in France. Yeah, that's right. It was France, the Paris suburb somewhere. And this guy comes out of nowhere and wants to have sex with the girl walking home. And she doesn't want to have sex with him, so he stabs her. You know, this is not how, there's a reason no one tried this before this mad age, is because societies are not meant to live like this. And I'd want to talk about that. And yeah, we'd be taken off if I was still on there. It's like so many other things where suddenly Nigel decides that he needs to do a two-hour show. they'll be talking about, you know, whether the Rwandan scheme can be relaunched. It's moved beyond that. Your country's dying. Glenn Flint says, hey, Mark, Sonia and I are looking forward to your next cruise from Barcelona to Portugal to Southampton. Given our membership in the Mark Steyn Club and my wildly inappropriate use of social media, Sonia was thinking we might be better off if you could drop us off in the Azores instead of the UK. If that's too much out of the way, we could pack a small inflatable raft and strike out for the US just as our ancestors did 400 years ago. You're probably in the double plus ungood category of the UK Thought Crimes Ministry. Given your health, joining us in the raft is not a good option. Perhaps Bear Grylls could arrange your daring escape by helicopter from the celebrity apex. The Soviet Union lasted 70 years, so waiting out the UK version is not a viable option for either of us. What's a thought crime cruiser to do? All the best, Glenn and Sonia. Well, you have the advantage on me. Nobody tells me anything. I didn't know that the Mark Steyn cruise was actually ending in Southampton. Used to be a great, it's a world famous cruise port, of course. I was thinking, you know, I was, because it saddened me all this. Just reading the daily horror stories from a great land that has been at the center of world history for so long, looking at it in its death throes. And I was thinking, I'd sort of forgotten this business about docking in Southampton, I was thinking, you know, I probably visited the United Kingdom for the last time. But Glenn and Sonia are ahead of me and know that I've got at least one more stop to make there. Peter says, hello, Mark. With respect to the demographic replacement of the people of Christendom, over the years we have asked you what is happening and why is happening, i.e. why would our elites do this? You've responded with books, essays, and answers here on Clubland Q&A. You've been correct all along for decades. Now, everyone can see that the consequences you warned of have arrived. For instance, even tuned-out normies in the UK now understand that their civilization is in its final death throes and will soon be replaced. So the question is, for those looking to preserve their heritage, culture, religion, and traditions, where do they go? Thanks, Peter. Well, you know, heritage, culture, religion, and traditions. I said, this was back in the 90s in the Telegraph, that I said I would look on certain of His Majesty's overseas dominions to be better guardians of the inheritance that the mother country has abandoned than Britain is. I was already thinking that way in the 90s. The trouble is, the normies can't see it. What's interesting now is that more and more parts of England in particular, including all the cities are all gone. They're just crime-ridden dumps. I mentioned today that England and Wales, they do the crimes that there's, for the purposes of the crime statistics, the UK has three jurisdictions because there's Scotland, there's Northern Ireland, and then there's England and Wales. Wales is just rolled in with England. I'm not sorry for you Welsh chappies, but you know why that is. It's because England, Scotland, and Ireland are kingdoms, and Wales is a mere principality. So in legal terms, there's three different jurisdictions. So England and Wales is a unitary jurisdiction. And they now have the highest rate of rape in Europe. They've apparently overtaken the Swedes. And you know this not because there's any great coverage of it, but you know this just which way the country's headed, just because of the way you know, nobody bothers. It's quite important to me because I, you know, do my work on a laptop. So it would be a big deal for me if a laptop were to be stolen from me as I was strolling along the streets of London. But laptops are stolen all the time. Telephones are stolen all the time. The police don't even investigate any of it. You can have one of these devices, you know, they're very cheap to get, where they put a little bug in your laptop or your telephone or whatever, so they know where it is. So if someone steals it, you can just go to this tracking thing and say, oh yeah, he's at 27B Acacia Gardens. And you then take that along to the police and say, oh look, I've got this thing and it shows the guy who stole my laptop is at 27B Acacia Gardens. And the police station, oh sorry, we're too busy in investigating what this tweeter said about the latest stabbing of a six-year-old girl. The cities are lost. And as I said, the most stupid thing that David Starkey has ever said to me was, oh, well, you know, there's still nice places in the countryside. Yeah, yeah, for the moment. But it's a fool's errand to think you can outrun the death of your country. I've said in respect to France that basically anywhere with any town with 3,000 or more people, 3,000 isn't a big number. They've got this issue. They've got this problem. Kyle Ryder says, oh, wait a minute, I didn't answer the whole question. Peter wanted to know those. Yeah, I don't think, here's the thing, I think it's better to split up places where you are rather than say, oh, I'll go to New Zealand, because most people don't know enough about any of the places they're fleeing to. Although you'd think with Jacinda Ardern that the idea that people would be New Zealand New Zealand seems far away until you get there. Then when you get there, you're in a New Zealand that is not as it was represented to you. So rather than do that, I think you've got to, I mean, for example, in the United Kingdom, I think it's just about possible to save, you could certainly save Scotland and Northern Ireland, maybe. But you won't be able to for much longer once these trends are in play. And the same thing would be true in the United States. The same thing would be true in certain Canadian provinces. You would have to, though, be very firm. And this is where the normies won't go with you. You would have to say, we're going to set up our little independent statelet. And we're not going to have any immigration. We're going to have a no. Nobody needs immigration. All the jobs are going to be done, you know, they're not going to require human beings. But people, the normies, even the normies who understand everything's wrecked, the normies are a bit like those flatlanders who flee Massachusetts for New Hampshire. And then after they've been in New Hampshire for 5 or 6 years or whatever, they start voting for all the crap that caused them to flee Massachusetts in the first place. People forget, particularly when you have had basically a half century of brainwashing. Celebrate diversity. You know, the king said it at his mother's Diamond Jubilee in 2012. He uttered the moronic phrase, unity through diversity. Well, it isn't really working out like that, is it, Your Majesty? That's why you had to go to Southport to comfort the families who lost their little girls. This is not how human societies were meant to live. But a half a century of, oh, celebrate diversity, the vibrancy of our diversity. You know, this is where I can't get excited. We're beyond elections now. We're beyond elections because this is what, I mean, if you take something like immigration, you know, even Trump, the problem in America is all immigration, illegal and legal. The country, the idea that this is why, again, don't wave that constitution at me. I'll tell you why. Because it's a constitution designed, what was, somebody put this in, I think, the comments or in a question last week, that I think at the time it was adopted, there were 3.5 million Americans. Now, as I say, there are 350 million officially. And actually, if you add in all the undocumented Americans, who are far more American than any of the guys who got off the Mayflower, at least in terms of their status in contemporary America, it's probably more like 400 million. And I don't think that constitution was designed for 400 million people. But, you know, that's a very good example. The open borders thing is a very good example of the limitations of the rock-ribbed Republican Congress and all the rest of it. Kyle Ryder. Sorry, Kyle, I got a bit distracted there. Says Charles Adler is headed to the Canadian Senate. If broadcast, this is a bit of a Canadian question. Charles Adler was on Sun News with Ezra Levant and Michael Corran. who's the one I like? Oh, Jackie Delaney. She was a laugh. Charles Adler is headed to the Canadian Senate. If broadcasters of that vacillating ilk go to the Senate, your pal Michael Corran is a shoo-in. You must have loads of gossip about TV and radio announcers across the Western world, so why not share with the Stein Online crowd your only true friends? Charles Adler, I didn't go on his show. I think I went on his show once. I was doing something at Fox, and I think we got a call that he wanted me on or something. So we went round the corner to some from Fox to some little cutout studio or whatever it was. I might even have done it from Fox. So we did it down the line with Charles Adler, and I thought it was absolutely terrible. And oddly enough, the thing I thought was that he was not a sincere person. Now, at that point, he was pretending to be right-wing. He's since, like Michael Corran, he's now switched and he's pretending to be left-wing. And I find this interesting, and this isn't just a Canadian problem. It's the same with America. When I think about Max Boot, for example, my old editor at the Wall Street Journal. Now, I take it because he was at the Wall Street Journal that he was more down the sort of economic conservative, libertarian end of things. But Trump drove him, you know, completely. He became full-blown never-Trumper. He's now in big trouble because it turns out his wife, with whom he has been writing all these co-signed pieces for the Washington Post, his wife has been indicted as a foreign agent. She turns out she's working for the South Korean government and getting all these benefits from them, supposedly, according to this indictment. And so all these pieces that that Mr. and Mrs. Boot have jointly authored and are still at the Washington Post, as far as I can tell. But he even before the problems with the missus, people, it's the same with Bill Crystal. People find it very hard. I've basically thought the same because I'm an old-fashioned kind of conservative. When I think about conservative heroes, as I once made the mistake of saying on a stage in Minneapolis, I name people like the Marquess of Salisbury. So I'm a very old-fashioned kind of conservative, and essentially I've held the same views on things since I was a teenager. All that's changed is that I no longer think that electoral politics is capable of fixing any of this. But what's interesting to me is how people just can't stick it. They can't stick it, and it's too much. And so all these people, Max, Bill Crystal used to be a complete sweetie when you'd run into him. He loved America Alone. He taught America Alone in some class he was teaching or whatever. And then Trump comes along and boom, he's gone. Right. And he's all on the side of the deep state now. When the deep state was obstructing Trump, he took the side of the deep, it's people can't stick. I think the combination, the social isolation, the déclassé aspect of it. Rush never cared about this. He was very unusual in that respect. Rush had a big pad in Palm Beach and he had a private jet. And even as they tried to inflict humiliations on him, like the business with the Monday Night Football, which was basically saying to him, yeah, you can make a lot of money in your right-wing ghetto, but you're never busting out of the ghetto. And that's why they kicked him off Monday Night Football. And people, a lot of people just can't live like that. People have commented on Lionel Shriver, who you asked for a bit of insider gossip, so I'll give you this for whatever it's worth. As some people will know, Lionel Shriver writes all these incredibly sensible columns. And then it gets to the last week in October, and she then does a column explaining why, notwithstanding everything she's written in the previous 3 years, she's going to be voting for Joe Biden. That's what she did last time around. Same with John Cleese, talks a lot of sense, and yet he can't. He can't bring himself to apply the logic of what he tweets to his vote. But with Lionel, I remember I interviewed Lionel. It's that you can see the show. It's up at Stein Online. I did a big interview with Lionel in, I think it was September 2016. So just before the Trump-Hillary election. And after the show, we're in the green room having a bit of a chit-chat, and she brings up the election, which we haven't. We've just done a terrific show on cancel culture, as I don't think they even called it then, and identity politics. I'm not sure they called it that then. And it'd been a cracking show, and everything she'd said made a lot of sense. And then we're in the green room, and we're chit-chatting, and she brings up the election, and she talks about Trump, and I sort of go, "Are you going to vote for Trump?" She said, "Oh, I couldn't vote for Trump. I can't stand the way he talks." And what she meant was that he doesn't talk. He talks, and he talks in his way that when you look at it on the page, it's not always in nice, clean sentences, but it's a style. And the style in which he talks and communicates his ideas is very effective. And I tried to make the point to Lionel, not terribly persuasively, but I said, because, you know, she's a novelist and I like reading novels, and a particular kind of novel I like, and you'll know this if you listen to Tales for Our Time, is I like the way you can tell who's speaking without it saying Fred said, Mildred replied, Nigel reacted, you know. I like, if you don't have to, you can tell who's speaking by the style in which the paragraph is written. And I said, that's the way to think of Trump. He's a brilliantly, if he were in a novel, he would be a fully formed character. He's got his own distinctive vocal patterns. Why would a novelist, of all things, be offended by that? Because that's a great thing. And she just couldn't get past it. And I don't know what she's planning to do this time round, but that word salad crapola of Kamala Harris, you know, when she says, have you ever stopped to think about the passage of time? The passage of time, right? Time is passing now, even as we speak. And that's an awesome thought, that simply as we go about our lives, the passage of time keeps passing. And she does all that when she does her word salad things. And as I said the other day, every single person who listens to national public radio in America thinks that's what it is. That's what it means to be articulate. And that's the terrible problem there. Biddeford Jake says, two men, Mark. What's this? Douglas Murray was being lauded and lionized on Sky News Australia recently, and his books paraded before the camera. Has he ever credited you for raising the same issues years earlier? Douglas has been on the Mark Steyn Show innumerable times. We've done two full one-hour shows with him that are there at the website. Douglas and I have shared stages from Malibu to Copenhagen, and you can see pictures of us together there. So it's perfect. Anyway, Clive James said his job was, quote, you know, Douglas is out and about, or because I'm sick. So I would die if I were to have Douglas's public speaking schedule at the moment. But Douglas and I've known Douglas for over 20 years. And as I said, he's been on the show time and time again. Clive James said his job was, quote, to shape a phrase until it catches the light. Having that gift yourself, I feel sure you two would have got on. I'm getting cranky now. I did get on with Clive. Clive and I corresponded regularly until, I forget, but not long before he died. Clive was a very good friend of my sister's, who my sister was his producer for a long, long time, and they were very close. But Clive at his website, I don't even know whether his website has survived him, but Clive at his website had pieces of mine linked there. He said I was the best writer on popular music since Alec Wilder, and that in some respects I was better than Wilder. He gave me a fabulous, well, he gave the show a fabulous review in The Guardian. he had one aspect of my personality that he didn't care for, but it was a terrific review. So I mean, it's probably the last really good review I got in The Guardian. So I feel sure you two would have got on. I did get on with him. I don't, this is a very strange, this is a very strange, I don't understand. I think if you want to ask a question about personal relationships with people, like with Douglas Murray or Clive, you should at least search the website a bit. Anyway, I'm getting... Bob He says, Mark, since you are an expert on dirty, stinking, corrupt judicial systems, do you have a prediction on what Merchan will do at President Trump's sentencing on September 18th and what effect that sentencing will have on the campaign? I listened to lots of the DC Superior Court outrage involving someone who got a dirty look in aisle 8 at Wegmans. There was ruinous financial impact for someone in spite of there being no case to answer. Warm wishes to you for good health and good fortune. Bob H. in Connecticut. I think the idea is to put him in jail if they can, right? And I think by then, by September the 18th, the question for the question for the Democrats will be whether they've kept Kamala Harris within the 6 or 7 critical states, whether they've kept her within close enough range to be able to work their usual magic in the small hours of Wednesday morning. And I think by September, there will be a lot of pressure on this judge to jail Trump, if he can get away with it. And if they think it works to their advantage, because they keep thinking, well, yes, we've indicted him, you know. And so he's the first president to be criminally indicted. So that's going to dent his numbers. OK, well, now he's actually on trial. So he's the first president to be just there as another criminal defendant in some lousy, corrupt American courtroom. So that's going to dent his numbers. OK, now we've actually tried him and it's gone to the jury and they've come back and found him guilty. So he's the first convicted criminal president in America. And none of it's worked. And a lot of them will still, because they want to do it. They want him in Rikers Island, and then they want something to happen to him in Rikers Island. And the fact that getting to, they'll say, oh, yeah, okay, so indicting him didn't work, and then putting him in the crappy courthouse didn't work, and then convicting him didn't work. But yeah, just you wait. When he's actually behind bars, that'll work. So I think they will do that if they think they can get away with it. Toby Pilling says, is Western civilization heading off the cliff, sinking to the bottom of the ocean, or rusting to a juddering halt? Which analogy best fits? I think we should be told. Well, I think actually that that yacht off Sicily isn't a bad metaphor. That guy, I mentioned him, he and his business partner were both acquitted in June by a San Francisco jury. And so they fly back to Britain. This is June, and it's now August. And the one guy decides that he's going to celebrate by taking a few friends, including some of his legal team, on this yacht. And the other guy decides he's not going to do that. He's just going to get his regular life back. Well, the yacht goes down off Sicily, and that guy has been missing now for 2 days. And the guy who just decided to go back to Cambridgeshire and get his life back, he was killed in a hit and run, which the Cambridgeshire police are asking if anybody knows anything about who perpetrated this hit and run. But two more enemies of the Department of Justice. So I think that the yacht is very poignant because it's a luxury yacht. And then, boom, suddenly it might as well just be some crappy old fishing boat because you're at the bottom of the sea. So I tend to, given that you've said you're sinking to the bottom of the ocean thing, I'm inclined to go with that. George Pazin, George Pazin says, I've been asking about free speech issues for weeks now, so switching to a fluffy bunny question this week. What sort of cuisine do you prefer? Hopefully your health issues haven't impacted your eating preferences too much. Did you see that Cammy is surging in the polls in West Podunk, Iowa? Is it too late to sub in Frozen Mitch for Trump? Yes, tanned, rested and ready. Mitch 24. That's what we need. What sort of cuisine? I like to eat real food, you know, so I just don't like processed food. And what annoys me in America is the control of the United States Department of Agriculture, which in the event that I ever ran for president, that would be number one on my platform, a plan to abolish all that. Because, what are the results health-wise for the American people? They're not good. RFK Jr. could tell you all about that. So eating processed, and also the minute you have a federal agency, it becomes a law. Lobby, like anything else. So you have the military-industrial complex, where you have 20-year wars that serve the needs of the big defense contractors. You have Big Pharma, where everybody's got to get jabbed every 20 minutes because it serves the interests of the big pharmaceutical companies. And you have the United States Department of Agriculture because it serves the interest of all the handful of big food players. And the processed food is terrible. I mean, if you're asking me about cuisine rather than which political regime, I like to eat fresh vegetables and fresh fish, and I like to eat real food. And one of the things I must say, I like the way my daughter and I, when my daughter flew into France to look after me when I was convalescing there, and she was just like preparing something to eat, and we were just standing at the window while it was, you know, whatever, it was cooking or whatever. And I pointed out to her, just looking down the hill, all the places where the various bits of food we were eating were going to come from. And I would advise anyone in a similar situation to treasure that experience. Because as you know, the World Economic Forum plan is that everybody should be eating from what Bill Gates makes in 5 food hubs. For the entire food hubs for the entire planet. Don't let him do that to you. Don't let him do that to you. Food is very important. I remember talking about this. I told a little anecdote. I think I repeated it a couple of weeks ago because I never go out now. So all my anecdotes have been heard before. But the one about being at a dinner party just after 9/11 in Paris and the guy saying, oh, well, the Americans, they think federalism is that you have a completely different set of laws in the town 5 miles up the road, whereas federalism in France means that in the town 5 miles up the road, you have a completely different collection of wines and cheeses from your town. And I thought that was I want it all. I think liberty is something that goes the whole way. So the fact that the contents of the average French cheese board are illegal under the United States Department of Agriculture is completely ridiculous to me. How's that working out for the people on the receiving end of American food regulation? And I remember, I think I said, it might even be in America alone. I was talking about the way, you know, Jonah Goldberg, I think it's a Simpsons line, he always mocks the French as cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And I said, well, you know, in that case, the Americans are cheese surrendering eating monkeys. And it wasn't a great line, but the surrender of the cheese is quite a big thing. Anyway, I hope that when we do go off the cliff, there's a decent cheese board at the bottom of it. This has been Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A across the planet. You want music? Tough. Because we moved all that to Saturday, Serenade Radio, 5 p.m. London time, which is 6 p.m. in Western Europe, or 12 noon North American Eastern. Do hope you'll join me this weekend. But that's going to do it for today. Stick with Steyn Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. And don't forget, in just a couple of hours, the latest installment of our nightly Tale for Our Time. Right here, The Flying Inn by G.K. Chesterton. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Steyn Club, come on in, the water's fine. And don't forget, for the Steyn shy chum in your life, there is a Mark Steyn Club membership with his or her name on it. Stay safe, stay free, stay well.
Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Steyn Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. Rights reserved.